Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Great privilege to be here, to be among friends, good friends. Dharma friends, all getting older friends. Lawrence is the youngster. But Lawrence, you're pretty, you're getting on too. And then to be practicing Dhamma in such a beautiful room, on such a beautiful property, at the end of Itipada, in such a silent space. In such a grand country, this is we're very fortunate. Really, I mean, if you really contemplate that, you're not cursed with a television in this monastery. Some of the news that goes on. So, if anything's a blessing, our life is blessed, huh? To be here. Or as we say, we're doing something right. We were talking about time, a tea time, and there goes the phone. That's all right. We have answer phones. So the world's always trying to kind of grab our attention. And time is the world, isn't it? Our appointments, our histories. I was born in Esslingen, and Igor comes and brings me a bottle of sauerkraut from Esslingen. And so that's history and time. And I live in Ottawa with my mom, and I'll be going back tomorrow in time. So there's that part of our life which is lived in time. And the liberation of the heart is not done in time. It's not the same kind of process. Because the liberation is always the awakening to the way things are and seeing them as Dhamma rather than as self. That's the sort of key to entering into the path in Buddhism. We call it Sakaya Ditti, personality view. So, in a monastery, we're trying to remember that viewpoint as we live our lives. And as we live our lives, what happens is many things, but one of the things that comes to consciousness are various kinds of moods. We feel happy, we feel sad, we feel inspired, we feel bored, we feel rushed, we feel pressured, we feel annoyed, we feel becalmed, we feel wise, we feel stupid. All these different kinds of moods of the mind come through consciousness. And our task isn't to become anything, to become someone who never experiences negative moods and only lives in some sort of idealized positive state, because the whole sense of becoming is one of the errors the Buddha talked about. So if you reflect on the second noble truth, that there is a cause of suffering, and the cause of suffering is attachment to tanha or craving, and that craving must be abandoned, must be let go of, must be relinquished. And then the third noble truth, that there is an end to suffering, and that end is the abandonment, letting go, relinquishment of craving. And that has been realized. So there's the attachment to craving, which must be let go of. And there's the abandonment of craving, which has been noticed and seen and realized. Right? And one of the three kinds of cravings is bhava. Bhava, tanha. And bhava is becoming. And another kind of craving is vibhava, Vibhava is negation of bhava. So vibhava is the getting rid of not being something. So becoming something that I'm not, or getting rid of something that I think I am. The two types of craving, which are all part of time. And then kama tanha is the whole sense of being distracted by the world, the sights and sounds and responsibilities and duties and bodily feelings and memories and ideas and plans. So there's kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. So you can see that if I'm practicing in time, if I feel I'm inadequate now, I've got anger problems, I've got fear problems, I've got this and that and that and that. In some sense, sure, that's true. I've got to understand anger and fear and so on. But if I'm practicing with the idea that I am inadequate now, and if I keep doing some practice called metta or whatever, that in the future I will not be inadequate, then I'm actually practicing becoming, aren't I? Mm-hmm. Bhava. And vibhava would be I'm trying to get rid of those things. So how do we practice? Well, we practice knowing this is a condition, it has arisen, it's unskillful, don't grasp it. That's always in the present moment. If I don't grasp the unskillful, then the unskillful ceases in consciousness. It doesn't obsess consciousness. But that's not done in time, that happens by itself. That's the law of karma. It takes care of itself. And if wholesome mind states are cultivated here and now, so if I reflect on goodwill and I actually activate goodwill and consciousness, that's not something I'm doing so that I'm a nice guy in the future, it's something I'm doing now, aren't I? So I recollect goodwill, I bring it to consciousness, I remember the feeling of goodwill. What does that feel like? And I keep recollecting that. That's something that's done here now. And then that becomes a force in consciousness, stronger and stronger. But that's always here and now. And the rest takes care of itself. So you have a sense of the goal. The goal would be the heart's liberated from anger and fear and hatred and things like that. But then you just have to keep your eyes on the path. Walking, walking, walking. You get there. It gets there, whatever way you want to put it. And so this is different than becoming, right? And now becoming is actually quite a hard thing to see, because there's some aspect of my habitual life which I don't like. Some form of sloppiness in myself or whatever, and I would rather not be that. And maybe I see it hurts someone, it hurts me. And I know I'd rather not be that. I'd like to be something else. Well, that can be part of chanda, as I was saying today. There's this good aspiration, this good desire that we have. But how does the mind actually work? How does the transformation take place from a person who is always anxious or always fearful to a person where anxiety and fear no longer are a problem? What is the transformation? Certainly, you could see it that it seems to happen in time. So I am less fearful than I was 20 years ago. And there is more compassion in the heart than there were 20 years ago. So you can see that operating. But the practice itself is not in time. The doing is always here now, here now, here now. So we're not trying to get rid of anything, we're not trying to become anything, but we are doing practices for the sake of doing practices. So that is important in understanding how your mind works, how the law of karma works, and what is effective. To not do anything, that would also be stupid, wouldn't it? To not make any kind of effort, and we're here because we want to. We have aspiration, we have this kind of yearning. So the ability to, first and foremost, to just awaken to the fact that I'm feeling that the habits of consciousness are negative and unskillful, just to awaken to that and to know that as a mood of the mind, rather than to take it as a personal problem. this is the step of what I mentioned with Sakkaya Ditti. If I've done something, if I'm, let's say I'm feeling maybe I've spoke to someone yesterday in a cruel way, I wasn't just lost in speech or something, and then today that memory comes up, what would Sakkaya Ditti be there? Sakkaya Ditti would be, I'm a terrible person for having spoken that way, and I'll never do that again, and I shouldn't do that again, and I'll really try in the future never do that again. That would be a strong sense of self. I'm this, and I want to become that. Which is okay, it's a wholesome kind of thought, but in noticing the mood of the mind, in practicing the third foundation of mindfulness, the mood of the mind, you see, this sense of regret or remorse has arisen because of causes. It feels this way now. And right in that moment, if you just know that, and you have compassion for that in this moment, then the next moment takes care of itself. You're not trying to become someone who never does anything, but you're trying to awaken right here and now to the consequences of each moment. So there isn't a sense of me going somewhere in this practice. Something happens, but it's not like I'm trying to get rid of the bad guys in order to get to the good guys. So it's not from craving that, say, anger is liberated or fear is liberated. It's from knowing that it is liberated. Knowing this is fear, it feels this way, or this is greed, it feels this way, or this is restlessness, it feels this way. So there's this constant awakening and knowing of things as a mood of the mind rather than as a personal problem. Or as a projection. That's another way we go, don't we? But the projection of blame, the projection of fear, whatever. But this is just fear. Or this is just anger. Or this is loneliness. Or this, whatever it might be. So if our practice is to be, I think, truly towards the deathless, it has to be always in this mode of not really going anywhere, but noticing how our attention is always stuck on that which is bound by time, that which is bound by birth and death. And if we see that, how our attention gets stuck into resentment, or gets stuck into regret, or gets stuck on blame, or gets stuck on depressive thoughts, or gets stuck on thoughts of self-hatred and self-disparagement. It's just that stickiness that we're concerned about. Right? And it's just that always, the mind always being preoccupied with an object. But when we can step back and say, that's just an object of mind. That's just a feeling. That's just a mood. Then we begin to incline towards deathless. Because what? We come back to the space, or to the silence, or to the emptiness, or to the knowing, or to the being, or to the witnessing, whatever way you like to use that. And that's ineffable, but it's always here and now. So this is why we talk about letting go rather than becoming. Letting go of resentment, or letting go of self-hatred, or self-disparagement, or self-judgment, all those things. What does letting go mean? It's just not being, just seeing, that's just a mood. That's what letting go is. It's a nicca dukkha anatta. It arises, it hangs in for a while, it ceases. As opposed to being someone who always needs to sort it out, or figure it out, or get rid of it. That's still the stickiness of samsara. So we might kind of awaken to the fact that we're feeling something, negative, positive, and then we start to analyze it, and we start to think about it, but it's still the same kind of stickiness. Whereas just knowing this is something that has arisen, and it will cease. It's very simple, very direct. So this difference between knowing a condition as a condition and taking it personally is what we mean by Sakkaya Ditti, personality view. And you can see, as long as I take it personally, I don't see it as dharma, then it'll always be someone who is inadequate trying to become something else. And that's endless. Like if I'm trying to change my personality, I don't know about you, but I'd love to have a different personality. Now, who wouldn't? Now, I'd be more intelligent, you know, have better memory, you know, be a better raconteur, have better knees, and, you know. All of us have that, don't we? You can go back, oh, for me. But that's all personality. We're not trying to become better personalities. That's the loveliness of monasteries. You don't have to be charming. You have to respect, you know, you have to kind of be decent. But it's not like rearranging the kind of inner geography of your consciousness to be whatever. It's non-becoming. And that can only be in awareness. That's the only thing that makes sense, isn't it? And that has to be realized. You have to see that that's the only logical thing this teaching could be taking you to. Anything in the future can't possibly be, because the future is always death-bound. It can't be in the future. It can't be a condition. It can't be a sight. It can't be a sound. It can't be a feeling. It can't be a memory. It can't be a personality trait. It can't be intelligent. It can't be stupid. It can't be male. It can't be female. It can't be big. It can't be small. It can't be me. It can only be the way things are. So there's this sort of realization. I think when you really ponder this teaching deeply, and you ponder why is the Buddha constantly saying the khandhas are the problem if you attach to them. They're not a problem if you don't attach to them. That sense consciousness is a problem if you attach to it. It's not a problem if you don't attach to it. That just the seeing of that, just the seeing that the only possible thing could be letting go into awareness. Anything else would be a red herring at the most it would be a disaster. When you see that, then you begin to also notice, well, I want to become something, or I want to get rid of something. That's the very problem, that movement away from, towards. Whereas awareness is not a movement, it's an opening. It's an opening to the suchness of this moment. Now, to me it seems that's what right view is about. Right view is this understanding, first and foremost, that no amount of becoming will liberate the heart. No amount of alteration of the sense experience to different kinds of ways is going to be liberating, because sense experience itself is transitory. So with that understanding, I think what happens is there's a willingness to endure. If I realize that anywhere I go is going to be the same thing, it's going to be unsatisfactory, then when the negative karma of my heart arises, like say fear, rather than shifting away from it or becoming someone who doesn't have fear, there's a willingness to just say, well, that's fear, it feels this way. And then one sees what's important is that not the fear itself, but what makes the fear possible, and that's awareness. You begin to move away from the object to knowing the knower, no matter what the condition is. And more and more it becomes apparent that it can't be the condition, that can't be it. I don't have to get rid of it. I don't have to alter it. I don't have to program it. It's nothing wrong with it, even though it might be mean, nasty. There's nothing wrong with it. It just is a condition. And the logic of that has to be clear. It has to come from a real insight that freedom cannot be in another place or another time. Cannot be. It can only be here now. Now that's not, like a lot of Buddha's, later Buddha's teachings got very metaphysical. So you get like things like on teaching on emptiness, that you know that none of this is essentially existent or real. Big deal. If I slap you in the face, it's still going to hurt. So you get these very kind of metaphysical things around Buddhism, which are very hard to understand. that samsara is nirvana, nirvana is samsara, and kind of. But if your knee hurts, your knee hurts, isn't it? So rather than getting very abstract, you can just see that right here and now, beyond all your views and opinions, life is this way. And then, if you can abide with life this way, this way, this way, what happens is the movement no longer has any power over you. It has no longer any power, and what you would discover is that behind it all, around it all, within it all, is a deep silence that is not dependent on your knees, on your emotions, on sights, on sounds, on experience. And that deep silence is the intuition of the deathless, isn't it? So that's not anywhere but here. So it's the intersection of the timeless with time. And you can't get that. You have to let go, and you notice it. So like Ajahn Sumedho's teaching on sound of silence, it's not a constructed sound like a concerto or something that you listen to. It's something that's always there that you remember. You remember awareness, don't you? You don't become aware. You just remember. Oh yeah. Think about when you're meditating, and you start thinking about tomorrow, and then all of a sudden. You remember, you didn't become aware, because awareness is always there. You make intentions to remember to be aware. But it's not the same as becoming good, or becoming strong, or becoming a better carpenter, or a better cook, or a better speaker, or a better listener. It's not that, because it has no quality. It has no real quality. So do ponder in your own heart, what is the difference between making intentions to, like if I make intentions towards goodwill, then it's a very skillful thing to do. But to awaken to that, what that is, and make that strong in the heart is different than trying to be a person who has goodwill in a kind of egotistical sense. I am someone who has too much anger, and I'm going to do a lot of metta practice so that in the future I have no anger. Well, what happens there is then each time anger comes, oh no, there's that anger again. I'm a terrible person, I have anger. But in the way of knowing the Dhamma of the mind as moods of the mind, that's just a mood, that's anger. It feels this way. No personality, not taking it personally. It's just known as the Dhamma. That's the Dhamma of anger. And the karma of attachment to anger, you know, is more anger. There's more ego, more separation, more alienation, so there's no attachment. And that's all we're doing here. We're just waking up. You know, it's really very elegant. It's very simple, but one can't underestimate the kind of painful processes our minds have gotten caught up into. Kind of painful things and habits our minds can go into. So it takes, again, a lot of endurance to look at some kind of resentment one has for something that's maybe long past, some cruelty that has been inflicted on one, and that comes flaring up into consciousness and sits there. And the courage of the practice is to say, whatever, I'm just here, give it to me. and to stay open-hearted to something, like if someone's betrayed me a few years ago, or childhood, I've been hurt, those memories are very, very painful, aren't they? And then if you take it as personality view, then of course there's the argument, either rationalizing one's hatred of that person, or resenting it, or then, no, it's 5 years ago, I shouldn't be feeling like this, I should have got through this by now. But it's all the same sticky mess. Whereas not taking it personally means, you could say, oh, this feels terrible. But terrible feels this way. Whereas taking it personally is the whole storyline and then hating oneself. And that's Sakkāya Ditthi. John Klein calls it personality view. No, calls it a psychological self. You see, like if I feel, if I have a memory of someone maybe insulting me in a public place, and then I got embarrassed or whatever, and then I come home, and then that comes up, not only is there's the feeling, but then there's the whole psychological self around it. They did this to me, and they did that to me, and it was unfair, and so this whole sense of a person in time, at that time, and then the future, well, if I meet that guy again, or if I meet her again, what am I going to say? I don't know what I'm going to, I'm never going to go there again. And that's what I mean by psychological self. It's a whole world that gets created from attachment. And it can be broken. The pain can't be broken. The pain has to recede. But the attachment can be broken in a moment by saying, this is a mood. And the mood feels this way. Then that pain can be processed. And it is still painful. But it's now witnessed, so that it begins to have some space around it, some freedom around it. And it can be liberated through the body, and so on. But as long as there's personality view, then it's the whole thing is not going to work. Because it's no longer, it's not seen as Dhamma. So we say you enter into the stream of Dharma, to the stream of Dharma when you let go of superstition. Superstition is in time. You think about it. I go to, like in Sri Lanka, they have a place called Kataragama. Kataragama is a kind of minor deity, and you go to Kataragama and you, let's say if you want to, if you're competing for university place, and you want to pass the university exams, you go to Kataragama, you make a vow, and chop a coconut, and you promise Kataragama that you will make certain offerings to the god Kataragama if you get into your position at the university. And if you do, then you go back and you make these offerings to Kataragama. That's superstition, isn't it? But superstition's in time. I'm afraid of something, or I want something, so I do this little activity to make me secure. A lot of our beliefs are superstitious. Because it makes us, helps us with the unknown. We don't know a lot, but we pick up all kinds of, you know, neat little ideas which kind of make us comfortable. So the superstitious mind always has right rituals and rites and beliefs which it kind of uses to bolster up its fearful aspects. But it also always has to do that. There was a woman in Wellington who had one of these Buddha amulets, and she thought it was very powerful. So that was her protection. So she went swimming and lost it. Mm-hmm. She was petrified. She was absolutely petrified. She came to us. And she didn't see that fear begets fear. And she got another one, but she was a mess. Mm-hmm. So superstition is a kind of, you know, you do the Buddhist thing or you do the Hindu thing or whatever thing you do, the Christian thing or the secular thing, and you think, well, if I do this little bit now, I won't have any pain or what in the future. But in letting go of superstition, you're accepting the fact that you don't know. You're not substituting that with some kind of belief system to. But you say, I don't know. This is what not knowing feels like. Then you are opening the mind to the deathless. But as soon as you don't know, if you fill it with superstition and then anxious thoughts and all kinds of beliefs, then you haven't really processed the sense of not knowing. You've just filled it up again. And then the not knowing will come again. It'll just go on and on and on. So superstition, or sila pata paramasa, is one of three that they talk about, the three fetters. The other is self-view, sakkāya ditthi, and doubt. Doubt in this way of practice, doubt Buddhist teachings, or just doubt itself. You notice how doubt works. You can't, if you're sitting with something like some difficult emotion, and you start to, am I doing this right? Maybe I should be doing something else. You never really stay with it. In meditation, if you don't just stay with something, you keep doubting, nothing happens. It enervates, it cripples you. So in those three, there is superstition or belief in rites and rituals, doubt, and especially sakkāya ditthi, personality view. You can see if you feel, if I feel regret for, let's say a woman comes to Ajahn Sumedho and she's had an abortion. And it was in London. And she's feeling full of regret, full of remorse, right? And she asked Ajahn Sumedho, what's the karma of that? What's going to be the karma of that? He said, well, here's the karma. You've got doubt. And that's all he could say. Now, she can just take that and say, oh, this is what it feels like to doubt and be fearful. And she can just stay with that and not create a self, oh, I did this, I had an abortion, I'm a terrible person for having an abortion. Just stay with that, and she can resolve that. And that's not taking it personally. Certainly it happened at a personal level, so there's the personal karma, as it were, but how do you get out? So rather than saying, I'm a terrible person for doing that, this is resultant karma, it feels this way. It just feels this way. And don't do it again, sure, but whatever, just this is how it feels. Otherwise we never get out of remorse and regret. And the same with blame, of course. Blame's the same way. Sakkāya ditthi, or psychological self, keeps creating time. If you look at how the worrying mind works, how the fantasizing mind works, how the regretting mind works, how the resentful mind, it's always me and that person, or me and me, and time, and past, and future, and it just keeps going on and on and on. And that's what samsara is about. It's this aimless wandering, just going on ad nauseum. And you can see that in your own mind. If you don't let go of personality, you just go on and on and on. But in a moment you can say, oh, this is what it feels like to go on and on. And all of a sudden there's space. And all of a sudden you realize, oh wow, this is what I'm doing. I'm just doing that with thought. And that's all we're doing. We're just waking up again and again and again. Now to bear witness to something like let's say if we talk about that woman who's feeling tremendous remorse about an abortion, for that to become conscious, that's very uncomfortable. The memory of that, or whatever, very uncomfortable. And rather than be with the discomfort, quite often the mind will go to thought, to guilt or to blame. If it's the other way around, if someone's betrayed me, then there isn't the feeling of blaming myself, there's the feeling of hurt and wanting to blame the other. And that comes up into consciousness and that burns, then of course that's unpleasant. So what do? I attach to something to get rid of the unpleasantness, so I hate. And I blame. Or blame myself, or I blame other. And it's the inability just to stay with this unpleasantness of a memory. Just to bear witness to it, to let it burn through you without creating a psychological self with blame or self-hatred. And just to bear witness to that fully, fully. Don't touch it. And that's where it's hard. That's where it's hard because it is unpleasant. We don't like to be with the unpleasant. But in that burning, and in that kind of willingness just to say, well, okay, this is it, whatever, mindfulness becomes very, very strong. Because even that is okay. Even that awful memory, whatever it is, that's okay. And so the way we, monasteries, we practice because we don't have distractions. Because we do, do winter retreats and so on, sometimes these things can be very powerful. But it's a good thing if it comes up, because now you have a chance to to not distract, not run away from, to really witness to that. Much of monastic life, of course, is just ho-hum. It's not dramatic. You know, much of it is just teetle-dum and tweedledee or whatever that is. Just the ho-hum of yet another morning, and much of it is very pleasant. You know, pleasant companionship and pleasant projects and that. So those are opportunities to also cut through sakkāya-ditthi, because even though it's pleasant, it doesn't mean you don't create self. The whole mindset of psychological self and time is always being created. So the intersection of the timeless and time, to apprehend the intersection of timeless with time, is the occupation of a saint. No occupation either, but a life lived in love, ardor, selflessness and self-surrender. A life lived in love. In ardor, the work is to just be present, just be present. And you have to love the work. Mm. You can't do it because the Ajahn says so. Or, I mean, you have to really love this work, don't you? You have to really kind of rise to the occasion of yet another boring morning. Mm. or you had another difficult mind state, whatever it might be. Selflessness and self-surrender. You can see that the sakkāya-ditthi it requires you really to give up to something. So there is the selflessness of service that's part of monastic life, isn't it? The kind of learning to live as a community and serve and give and so on. But also there's that selflessness of this is not self. This is not who I really am. I'm not this resentful or frightened or excited or depressed or whatever you want. That's not who I really am. It's not who you are. None of us are that. It's just stuff. Stuff which tends to fool us into thinking that's who we are. And that perspective of spaciousness and stepping back and knowing, it's just conditions of mind. And each of the teaching points to that in so many ways. So when we see this as, like when we see a mood as impermanent, we see it as Dhamma. When we see it as permanent, as mind, then we're not in the path. So we're trying to see the Dhamma rather than personality. And that's what we're doing all the time. Same old stuff. You hear the same talk now for the next 20 years. I'll be saying the same thing. Be in my wheelchair. Yeah, I'll be falling asleep. You'll be falling asleep in your wheelchair. You'll all be saying, wake up. It's a very simple principle, and it's only our minds that are complicated. Our habits which are complicated, our emotions which are complicated. But the solution is very elegant, very simple. So I'll leave that for tonight for your reflection.
Annamayam namakathaya sadhu karangadamase. Sadhu.